This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
And good morning to you, Roger, and good morning to the world as it's time for our weekly get-together on Saturday morning here on WGN Radio. And Roger, this is looking like quite a snowstorm moving across the central part of the country.
Yeah, it does.
And it's going to play havoc, apparently, with flight schedules. One of the things I noted is that there were many cancellations and 12,000 delays, flight delays already, and 1,431 flight cancellations. But the thing that you mentioned in your sports coverage that is of concern, although the Kansas City area is expected to get up to 6 inches of snow, it should be over by the time the Chiefs begin the National Football League playoff game. So maybe that will escape just a little bit, but we're certainly going to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, I'm looking at the edge, the western edge right now, and it's moving through Kansas City. It's almost through there now.
Okay, so they'll get the field cleared in time probably for the football game.
Should do it.
All right, we'll check in with you later, sir. We're at 10 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show. And I just want to cover this weather bulletin in a little more detail because the massive winter storm hitting the U.S. Rockies and Plains yesterday, moving eastward with snow set to fall in an 1,800-mile corridor through the weekend, creating, quote, transportation havoc in the middle of the country. System started as rain from Mexico turned to snow as it met icy air, and up to 18 inches of snow expected in the mountains south of Denver, according to the National Weather Service. As the storm heads east, up to 16 inches of snow likely in western Missouri and St. Louis. And areas to the east could get about 6 inches with ice developing in Kansas and Arkansas, and up to 4 inches of snow in Washington, D.C., before the storm heads out to sea late on Sunday. One weathercaster said the storm is expected to create havoc over the central part of the country and then extend eastward into the mid-Atlantic states. So while the storm will spare the heavily populated Northeast, it will likely disrupt air travel and auto travel from Kansas City to Indianapolis and bring the heaviest snowfall so far this winter to Cincinnati and the Ohio River Valley. So it's going to be a pretty good one. If you're planning to travel by air, probably expect long delays and cancellations, and if you're going to be traveling by road, icy conditions could be the force in a large part of the country, so be careful driving. Well, we have a lot to talk about here on the Saturday morning show, particularly where Steve Alexander is going to talk to a research person who said we shouldn't blame cattle and other animals for the big changes in the atmosphere and all of that. So we're going to talk about that. And then markets, of course, continue to be a big question mark every day. And while we've been talking about trade agreements and disagreements with China, we're now going to start talking about another trade situation. The U.S. and the European Union will be meeting very soon to talk about some trade differences between those two parts of the world. And the American Farm Bureau Convention is underway in New Orleans, and they've got quite a lineup of speakers coming into that event. Max Armstrong will be covering that for us, as he looks in on 6,000 Farm Bureau members at New Orleans, Louisiana, They've been gathering there the past several days, and the convention officially opened yesterday, and it will continue till next Wednesday. So we'll talk about all that and more, but stand by, because we'll call on Steve Alexander when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Thank you, Mr. Manfredini. And right now we're going to check in with Steve Alexander, who has an interesting guest and an interesting topic. Steve?
Orion, the people who want to eliminate animal agriculture are aggressively pursuing this goal in a number of ways. One is by claiming that eating meat and dairy products is unhealthy. Another tactic is claiming that agriculture, and specifically cattle, sheep, and goats, contribute to greenhouse gases that are changing our climate. And they go on to claim, wrongly, that farm animals are more to blame than other contributors, such as industry and cars and trucks and airliners. Joining us to inject some fact-based information into this debate is Professor Frank Mintlerner, who is an air quality specialist and animal scientist at the University of California, Davis. Frank, let's begin with a broad view of this issue, if you don't mind. Maybe one from 30,000 feet, since I mentioned airliners. And this question, are animals really a problem when it comes to climate change?
Well, that's certainly in the eyes of the beholder. If you ask me, I would say that they are not a problem. But there are some people, and many people actually, who think that animal agriculture is not a problem, but the biggest problem to many societal issues, including climate change. I can assure you that you haven't seen nothing yet, as they used to say. Next week, actually, will be the starting point of an international alliance putting out a multi-million dollar campaign against animal-based foods. This will be called the Eat Lancet campaign. And that Eat Lancet campaign will be multi-million dollar, international. It will be going through the media for months and months and months, and you will all hear about this for sure. Now, what is behind this? Well, think about it. If you were to produce plant-based alternatives to meat, let's say a plant-based burger or a cell-based burger, then how would you sell that thing? You would sell that alternative to meat or milk or so by poo-pooing the original. And that's exactly what they do. They don't try to establish themselves as an alternative that you can pick or choose, or, you know, you can like it or not. They want to get rid of the original in order to establish new market shares. That's one group doing it. Then there are a bunch of vegetarian and vegan stakeholder groups who are behind this. Then there are all different kinds of organizations and individual scientists behind it. There is a massive business interest behind it, because plant-based foods, oftentimes processed, are very lucrative, because the ingredients for these plant-based foods are relatively cheap. And how do you sell them? You sell them by basically discrediting the animal-based original. That's exactly what's going on right now.
Well, you posted a quote on Twitter from the founder of Impossible Burger, which is a plant-based food that tries to look and taste like beef. He made it clear what the mission of his company is, and that is to replace the use of animals as a food technology globally by 2035, what he called the most important mission in the world. And I was going to speculate on his motives as being profit, for the most part. But as we look at if this actually happened, has anyone projected how the climate and the earth would look without animal agriculture?
Well, let me tell you something, because you just quoted him as saying this would be the most important mission in the world. I think it would be the most important mission for him and not for the world, because obviously this is his business interest.
Right.
I think that if we were to totally stop using animals, for example, here in the United States, let's say we were to stop using animal agriculture, and we were to become a vegan society, then, and this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by my colleagues Hall and White, if we were to all turn into vegans, we would reduce the carbon footprint of the United States by 2.6%. The effect it would have to the world greenhouse gases would be 0.3%. So if all 320 million Americans would become vegans, we would reduce global greenhouse gases by 0.3%. Now, that's not nothing. It's something, but I think everybody will agree that that reduction would be very minor. And what I'm very critical of is that those people who you will start hearing from next week make it sound as if a change in your eating habit would make up a profound change in such an important issue as climate change. And that is not the case.
I saw a video from that was posted by The Economist, in which a professor at Oxford, I don't remember his name, he said that if the entire world went vegan by 2050, food-related greenhouse gases could be reduced by 75%.
So, first of all, he is not a professor. His name is Marcus Brinkman, and he is a postdoctoral fellow. And he is one of the main initiators of this Eat Lancet campaign. This gentleman is a very radical vegan, and you will hear and see a lot more about him and from him in the near future. So you have to really listen very carefully as to what he says. He said food-related greenhouse gas emissions would be reduced by 75%. What he doesn't say is what food-related greenhouse gases contribute to altogether. Let me give you one number that I think is very telling. The entire U.S. food supply chain, all the food that we consume in the United States, plant and animal origin together, make up 1% of global greenhouse gases. So 1% of all greenhouse gases in the world stem from what we produce and eat in the United States. And 0.5%, half of 1%, is the contribution of U.S. livestock production and consumption. 0.5%. So if all of us were to stop eating meat, then we would have a reduction that would be so small that it would not be measurable. Yet he promotes it in a way that it would be an absolute game changer. And that is nothing more than propaganda, in my opinion.
Well, let's acknowledge that this is a very emotional argument for some people, people who don't wish to eat anything with a face on it, for example. And that's certainly their right. I honor that. But let's stick to the science. And what does the science say about the methane that is coming out of the front and back ends of cows and other ruminants?
Yes. Well, here the discussion gets very complex quickly. But let me explain it. I hope in understandable terms. So CO2, carbon dioxide, and methane are not created equal. CO2, once it's released into the atmosphere, lives there for 1,000 years and longer. It's not being destroyed at any meaningful rate. The CO2 you put out with your car 20 years ago is still in the atmosphere. Methane is very different because methane only lives for one decade. And that is a fundamental difference because we live in a world pretty much where methane continuously is produced also by livestock, but not only by livestock, and methane is put into the atmosphere. But almost the equal amount, and now think about what I'm saying here, almost the equal amount that we put into the atmosphere with sources like ruminant animals or rice paddies or swamps or so, almost the equal amount of methane we put into the atmosphere gets destroyed in the atmosphere because there is a chemical reaction called oxidation. And that means there is a certain chemical fraction in the atmosphere called hydroxy radicals. And these hydroxy radicals take methane and destroy it, convert it. And that destruction of methane occurs almost at the same rate as the production of methane. And because of that, in my opinion, the whole discussion about livestock producing a lot of methane, which then is detrimental to our climate, is a discussion that we will soon revert. Because the people who lead this discussion act as if methane were to be added and would accumulate, but it doesn't accumulate. If we don't change the number of livestock that we have and that we have had, which is the case, by the way, then we are not adding new methane to the atmosphere. And as a result, we are not adding new global warming. Meaning, if you have constant livestock herds, then you're not adding new methane. because what you added 10 years ago is now gone. So you are staying at a plateau, you're staying at an even plane, and as a result of that, you're not adding new warming. And I know that's very theoretical, and it takes a long time for people to wrap their minds around it, but I think we are about to change history around the definition of what methane does, why it's so different from CO2, and why the critics of livestock are so wrong.
I feel like we should get college credit for this interview. There is so much more to this issue that we didn't have time to include, but if you would like to keep up on the latest regarding the science of greenhouse gases and the agricultural piece of it, I encourage you to follow Professor Mitt Lerner on Twitter at GHGGuru. GHG, like greenhouse gases, guru. Back to you, Bigo.
All right, and you're right. I think we should get a college degree because some of it was above my capability but of reasoning. But I like what he's saying because all along, the thing I've wondered, if livestock produces that much with the atmosphere, what happened when we had thousands of bison roaming across North America? But I guess maybe there was not a scientist around to talk about that impact. Well, we'll take a break for news headlines, but before we do, here is this on the Saturday Morning Show. It's the Saturday Morning Show here on WGN Radio Chicago. Good to have you along for our weekly get-together. As I mentioned earlier, Max Armstrong, along with about 6,000 Farm Bureau members in New Orleans, for the Centennial Convention, the 100th Convention of the American Farm Bureau Federation. He'll be covering that activity this weekend. And when we come back after the news, we'll take a quick look at some of the speakers on that program at the American Farm Bureau Convention in New Orleans, the Big Easy. So stay with us for that. And, of course, markets continue to be a major topic of conversation in the agricultural community. And some impatience with what's coming out of the Chinese-U.S. talks as far as purchases of soybeans. Traders apparently disappointed with the smaller numbers than they expected. And we've talked about that, but we'll be talking more about it. Dale Dirkholz will be with us and join Max in just a few minutes. We're at 25 minutes before 6 o'clock here on the Saturday Morning Show, and I'm hoping that weather situation will not impact the travel of Farm Bureau members, particularly Max Armstrong, to New Orleans to cover the 100th anniversary convention of the American Farm Bureau. More about that coming up, but right now, time for Samuelson Says. I'm Orion, and today, talking about a situation I've discussed many times on Samuelson Says over the past decade or so. So let's talk about my concern over the possibility of spreading livestock and crop disease not only around the world, but particularly here in the United States. And that brings me to the travel season, particularly for those of you who travel outside the borders of the United States. If you're planning on doing that this year, a couple of things I want to remind you of. When you come back, flying on the airplane to come back into the United States, before you land at your U.S. airport, the flight attendants will pass out a card, a questionnaire card from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And there are questions on that card that deserve honest answers from you because they are critical in keeping crop disease and livestock disease out of the country. The question that I want you to answer honestly is, have you been on a farm or have you visited a livestock farm or a crop farm on your foreign visit? And if so, where and when? And if you have, by all means, answer that question honestly. because it may take you a couple of extra minutes to come through customs and immigration when you come back into the United States. If you have been on a farm or in contact with livestock and crops, you may be asked to wash your boots in the tubs that they provide at the airports for you to do that, to make sure that we don't bring any of these diseases back into the United States. There's foot and mouth disease. There's currently African swine fever. There is bird flu. And there is all sorts of problems that could be brought into the United States that would impact the production of food in this country. And so, once again, I ask you, be honest when you fill out the answers on that information card from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and make sure you're not responsible for bringing a crop or livestock disease into the borders of the United States, because it could be disastrous to our agricultural community. So make note of it. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. Time to talk about markets, and boy, what a conversation that is and has been for the past year or so, and it's not going away. So Max Armstrong will join us with his guest to talk markets when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show.
Podcasts are all the rage these days, and this week we convene our 2019 Outside the Loop Podcast Summit and hear from some successful local on-demand audio storytellers about how they pursue their craft.
Mike Stevens, Outside the Loop, up next at 6
on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Dale Durkos with AgriVisor sitting at the microphone with us this weekend. We have seen the soybean market at times over the past week to 10 days showing some signs of life, and wheat has risen some. What's your assessment of what we're seeing right now?
You know, the interesting twist, when you look at the grains, the latter half of December, the market was all down. Since we opened up and started the new year, the market's basically been higher almost every day, with the exception of one. So, you know, it's kind of like we transitioned from one side to the other, and that's really not unexpected. We had some timing stuff that said things were going to change at the new year. We also have to look back. A lot of the big investment houses said they thought commodities were going to be a good investment vehicle in 2019. So I think they were taking advantage. We've seen a bit of a push, a bit of a bulge in the grain markets. Beans and wheat have both been stronger. So I think we're setting the table for a little bit better time here in the early part of 2019.
No January crop numbers that we generally look forward to seeing, and I'd heard some conjecture that those probably would have been friendly to the market. What's your feeling?
The attitude is yes. You know, when you look at the primary numbers, corn yield, you know, a bushel and a half, pick your poison there, that people think we're going to reduce that corn yield from where they were back in November. So let's talk 177, 177.5. Bean yields, I think, are probably going to go down a quarter to maybe a half a bushel, take them underneath 52 bushels again. And the winter wheat acres, the longer we grind into this, we're getting people thinking, you know, we didn't plant the winter wheat acres this year that we did a year ago. So we're down under 32 million now.
Globally, the Brazilian crop, we're seeing some private estimates, even in the void of USDA numbers, private estimates are coming down on that crop size, are they not?
And even official estimates, Thursday morning, CONAB came out, put out their official numbers. They went down about 1.5 million ton, down to 118.8 million ton on the bean crop. They made some very minor changes in first crop corn, but nothing really big, so we'll call it unchanged. But a lot of the private trade, we're sitting here right now, a lot of people thinking, you know, 116, 117, 118. I know there's some people that are down there 113. I even heard of one 110. But I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration, at least where we are for the moment.
That's still a lot of soybeans.
It still is a lot of soybeans. There's no doubt about it. It basically is still going to roughly match, you know, the crop we had here in the U.S. last year. You know, right now you basically look at these two heavyweights as producing about the same amount.
timing is critical, is it not, for the arrival of that crop and from Brazil when it starts coming out of the field?
Well, they've already started some real early harvest. There was some stuff even done before the end of the calendar year. But what we're seeing right now, you know, and we're still in the very early stages yet. In Mato Grosso, I haven't even seen an official harvest number yet. So I think, you know, 2, maybe 3% at most, even nationwide. It's really a small base. By the time we get to the end of January, we'll be starting to pick up a little bit. Beans were planted early this year, and we hear there were a lot more early beans planted too. I'm talking fast maturity varieties. People have come to that realization, and that's why some of these production yield numbers have been gravitating downward. People going, you know, not only are crops not as good as we thought because of weather and in some key areas, but, you know, these early season varieties are a yield drag too.
While we have seen some purchases of our soybeans in the global marketplace, is that going to dry up once that Brazilian crop comes in?
Well, I really don't think so, because, you know, where we're at right now, you know, China's imports are down a little bit. Basically, the African swine fever is still being a bit of a drag over there, and their supplies are a little more comfortable. Bean meal demand in China is a little bit of a drag. But they're still going to be a heavyweight reaching in here, buying what is available coming out of South America, start looking ahead to their spring and their summer needs themselves. So that's going to continue to push the rest of the world back to the U.S. And actually, if you go back and look at soybean purchasing patterns or shipping patterns prior to when China became a heavyweight, let's say the early 90s, you find that we're really following that track. And if that's the case, both sales and shipments probably are going to remain reasonably good as we go all the way into the middle, maybe even late spring.
With the business that we'll do with countries other than China, you're saying?
Oh, yes, of course. That's one thing I think people didn't do. They didn't step back and go, what's the world like without China? And also without Brazil and Argentina, because China's going to absorb the most of those supplies.
Speaking of China for just a moment, let's talk about that African swine fever situation. There are some livestock analysts who say this thing is huge, not just within the borders of China, but spilling out through the rest of Asia and Europe, and that it probably hasn't all been taken into account yet. How do you see that?
Well, the issue with African swine fever is the unknown. You know, and that's the real difficult part. You get into any kind of disease issue, especially something like this, that we really don't have any good known vaccines for at this point yet. Yes, it is a problem in China. They haven't done a good job managing it up till now, although we've been seeing some steps they've been taking here of recent. But still, you know, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, I think I read a story. They had found some traces of African swine fever in livestock feed. It's called, come on, folks, you need to get all those livestock products out of it, because that just perpetuates the problem. It is going to be a bit of a drag. How big? I don't know. I think it's hard to quantify. I think the bigger risk is, you know, being able to look or being able to make sure it stays contained in, like, here in the U.S., maybe even in South America. Europe, you know, we go back last fall, they found a wild boar that had it. Well, they've been able to keep it together. They've been able to manage the issues as it is. So I think we're okay there. So I think it's these other big producing heavyweights, like here in the U.S. or in Europe, maybe even in South America, we need to watch real closely.
What is the amount of the irreparable damage we've done to our trade in terms of the Chinese market? Long term, I'm talking about.
Boy, to try to put a number on it, it's really
difficult. You've watched this scene for a long time. What's your gut feeling?
Oh, there's no doubt we've done harm to it. Because any time you go back, and we can talk about the early 70s in Brazil, you know, and we had our trade embargoes back in 1973 on soybeans because we were running out. Japan invested a lot of money in Brazil, and all of a sudden we had production down there start to flourish, at least the early stages. Same thing occurs now. You know, we basically took on China, which I think needed to be done. That I don't have any problem arguing about. But it has done damage to the ag trade, no doubt about it. It's business that you're going to have difficulty getting back to where we were, because it isn't so much that we've damaged demand base, you encourage production elsewhere, and that isn't going to go away.
Exactly. As we take a look at the Chinese economy, its growth was already slowing ahead of the trade war. What has happened with this dispute that has extended back to the middle part of last year?
You know, you continue to see some economic numbers that float out in, you know, whether they're major economic numbers or you look at anecdotal evidence, you know, of what's going on anecdotally. The trade spat we've had with China has had some serious repercussions back into their economy. And I think the seriousness of that and the extent of that probably played out in the negotiations that took place in Beijing last week, in which we had some undersecretaries meeting with some of their undersecretaries and work out some of the details of these trade issues we're talking about. Their lead negotiator showed up to the meeting. And that said, they're really serious about trying to find some way out of the trade problems we're having right now.
Let's talk about farmers this winter and what kind of things you're hearing from them and what you're sharing with them. We hear about a lot of stress, financial stress out there, and some very serious discussions with bankers. Are you hearing that?
There's no doubt about it. You know, the farm community itself is really feeling the impact, you know. When you go into the western parts of the Corn Belt where prices and basis levels are even worse than they are here in the heart of the Corn Belt, and I hear farmers in Illinois even complaining about the basis levels on beans, for example. But you are hearing stories about financial stress, economic stress down at the farm level. I don't think it's going to go away. The market facilitation payment, you know, is a little bit of salve on the wound in here. I think it's going to help out a little bit. But certainly more than anything else, we need higher prices to come along to at least take some of the pressure off the farmers themselves. I think we're probably going to see some of that here over the course of the next couple of months. I've got some timing things that show that we can have low in corn, low in beans in April, maybe late March at the earliest. So that's one of the areas that I think farmers need to be very aware of. You know, make sure you have your cash needs covered for the spring and into early summer before we hit that late March-April time period.
We would be remiss if we didn't mention the fact, though, that there were some very good yields reported by some farmers in 2018, and that's softened the blow a little bit, hasn't it?
Oh, no doubt about it.
I mean, I think of those reports I heard out of West Central Illinois on soybean yields around Jacksonville and that particular region about bean yields approaching triple digits. That makes up for some of that deficit in price, doesn't it?
It doesn't matter if you're talking about beans or if you talk about corn. I mean, universally, you know, except for those isolated areas, we really had a good crop again this last year. And nothing really replaces having bushels to sell, you know, and it does offset some of the lower price drag that we're getting here at this point, and it keeps that base income relatively high. But at some point here, you need to see some higher price levels come along the way because you aren't guaranteed having those great yields year after year.
We'll have a few weeks from now USDA generating some outlook numbers. And
hopefully.
That's true. I never thought about that. You know, that whole thing could be backed off a little bit too, could it not, if the partial government shutdown continues?
Yeah, it's right now it's scheduled for somewhere around the 20th, 21st of February. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the exact date of it at this point. The issue becomes, though, with that particular meeting and putting together a meeting like this, How do you change the timetable? You really can't. You know, because of meeting space, all the people that are committed to come and speak at the meeting, et cetera, to delay it, that's almost an impossibility. So if the government shutdown extends, let's say, beyond the 1st of February, I would imagine there's going to be some real pressure inside of Washington to go, you know, we're just going to have to cancel this thing. Because if you push up too close to it and you don't have USDA people working, you don't have the groundswell of things that are done necessarily for the USDA's portion of those presentations, it makes it difficult. The only thing they could do is reach out into the industry and bring some private people in to kind of fill in the blanks in there and some of that meeting detail itself, and maybe you could still pull it off. But with a government shutdown, there's a lot of things that are unknown.
You always shed some light for us, sir. We appreciate your visits. Thanks for coming in.
It's always good being here.
Dale Durkles with AgriVisor.
Something unusual will be happening in New Orleans at the 100th anniversary convention of the American Farm Bureau Federation. For the second year in a row, The members and delegates will hear an address from the President of the United States. President Trump will address the Farm Bureau Convention on Monday at the closing general session. And listen to the rest of the lineup that's going to be appearing at the convention in New Orleans. Vice President Mike Pence scheduled to be there. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue scheduled to speak. And then USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Ted McKinney from Indiana on the schedule, coming off his week of trade discussions in China. Also speaking will be Senate Agriculture Committee Chairman Pat Roberts, Senator Jerry Moran of Kansas, Representative James Comer of Kentucky, and Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith of Mississippi, all appearing on that program. Ted McKinney, of course, spent that time in Beijing with the U.S. negotiators talking about trade and particularly about agricultural trade. He brings a good knowledge to that area. So it's quite a lineup of speakers that will be on the program at the American Farm Bureau Federation in New Orleans. That convention continues through the Wednesday of next week, when they'll do the final work on resolutions and policy for the next year. One other thing that we want to mention, the United States yesterday signaled it would not bow to the European Union's request to keep agriculture out of the planned trade talks between the United States and the European Union. And the U.S. published negotiating objectives that seek comprehensive EU access for American farm products. The objectives required by Congress under the Fast Track Trade Negotiating Authority Law seek to reduce or eliminate EU tariffs on U.S. farm products and break down non-tariff barriers, including on products developed through biotechnology. Earlier in the week, the trade commissioner of the European Union said that the 28 country bloc could not negotiate on agriculture in a new, more limited set of negotiations expected to start this year. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to that battle between the EU and the US, because we do have problems getting products into the European Union over biotechnology issues. So that's one to watch. Well, we're coming up to news headlines time once again. And just a couple more things to mention here on the Saturday morning show when we continue. One other Farm Bureau convention note. Tomorrow, the American Farm Bureau Federation will be presenting its highest honor, the Distinguished Service Award, to Senator Orrin Hatch, and the Farm Bureau Founders Award will be presented to Dick Neufer of Pennsylvania during the AFBF 100th Annual Convention. That, along with a lot of other activities, will be on the schedule for tomorrow in New Orleans at the Centennial Convention of the American Farm Bureau Federation. Well, thank you as always for joining us. Our thanks to Brett, our engineer, who makes it all happen without anything wrong happening on the show, and thanks to him. But most of all, thanks to you for joining Max Armstrong and yours truly, Orion Samuelson, on the Saturday morning show.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.